In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, how to use baking soda for performance, natural ways to increase glutathione, can mud help you recover faster, what to do about snapping hip syndrome, the anti-aging effect of saunas, and much more.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
So you yet again packing up and getting on a jet plane tomorrow morning, jetting off into the atmosphere.
You know why? Because I have a insert sailing music here.
Oh, I thought you meant the like Supertramp
or that. I'm going on a cruise. I'm going on the Spartan cruise. I'm taking my family on the Spartan cruise. So I got up early this morning before our recording here, and I packed all my cruise stuff, all my healthy travel cruise stuff.
Oh, your cruise stuff, like your old man hat and your Teva sandals,
exactly.
Your knee high socks.
Basically activated charcoal to combat all of the strange foods that you encounter on a cruise ship. And then glutathione, which of course we'll talk about later on in this podcast, to combat the effects of the drinking that I may be doing on said cruise. So,
what? Drinking?
No, actually, I have like kind of like my travel go-tos that are pretty much like the same things I grab in my pantry or in my health cabinet every single time that I travel. And yes, charcoal and glutathione are two things that I do throw in there for like the whole toxin management piece. But then one thing, and this is just my standby, is I grab a Ziploc bag and I fill it full of some kind of meal replacement powder. And I'm not necessarily like brand specific, but typically it'll be something from the Living Fuel company. Like I use this stuff called Super Greens or Super Berry.
Oh, like and, super berries. Yeah. Quite delicious.
The problem is it has the texture of baby food. If you just like wander up to a Starbucks, which I do in the airport, and mix it with water. So yeah. I put it in the Ziploc bag, but then I'll add like a handful of whatever crunchy goodness happens to be in the pantry, like almonds or walnuts or coconut flakes or dark cacao nibs. And I'll just throw that in there along with a plastic spoon. And so when I wander into any random airport place where I have access to a water or cup or even on an airplane, I pretty much make myself a little bit of a, almond and nut infused baby food goodness. So
delicious.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Real babies.
I do a little bit of like some kind of an organic beef jerky usually, just so I can feel all manly and cowboyish sitting on the plane.
Last plane I was on, I had an Epic Bar, one of those, the Bison Bacon Epic Bar. That was a nice way to tide it over.
That's exactly what I'll use. Usually the Epic Bar or on it has like this pemmican bar, which is like the rendered fat of bison, which makes great conversational fodder for whoever happens to be sitting next to you.
The vegetarian that's sitting next to you.
Hey, what's up? I'm eating a giant animal that used to be roaming the plains. How's that kale?
Rendered and dry.
And then what else do I pack? I'll usually pack some kind of a dessert-y bar so that when I have that craving for chocolate or sweets or whatever, on the airplane or when you're traveling or when all your hormones get dysregulated from, hopping across time zones, you can kind of quell that craving without doing too much damage. So I'll grab like, usually again, it's not super duper brand specific, but like for this particular trip, I pack the new, like the Yucan super starch bars that are like chocolate.
Oh, you've got some
peanut
of those
butter flavored. Yeah. I got an inside deal on a box. Sometimes I'll do the Hammer Nutrition bars too. The Yucan bars are actually good. Yeah. Yeah, they taste like chocolate peanut butter. They taste like Yucan superstarch all like mashed together and then covered in chocolate and peanut butter. So
that'd make it better. Yeah. I can't say that I'm a fan. Like the Yucan works well, but it doesn't taste fantastic. So
yeah.
But covered in chocolate and peanut butter.
Yeah. Actually, I'm talking to the folks at UCAN because we're gonna hopefully add that box for folks over at greenfieldfitnesssystems.com to be able to order themselves some tasty UCAN goodness along with the nice other stuff they get. So yeah, those are some of the main things. And then of course my insert geeky biohacker evil laugh here, my electrostimulation unit, so that I can shock the heck out of my quads and hamstrings and all that jazz when I'm sitting around. So
on the plane.
So yeah, that's it. I'll chomp on my pemmican while I shock myself and pop a couple activated charcoal capsules, and I'll be the healthiest little traveler ever.
That's like the antithesis of me when I was in the band. I remember there was one trip in specific. They flew us up north because nobody ever goes way up north in Canada to tour. So they paid us a lot of money to go up there, and it was only like 4 days. So I threw 2 pairs of clean underwear, 2 pairs of socks, my pajamas, my toothbrush in like a plastic bag, and that was it.
Yeah, that's a good approach too. But you know,
it was awesome. Actually, the third show, I wore my pajamas on stage because my clothes were so dirty, and nobody said anything. So
I'm wearing whatever. A sailor outfit.
Of course. Every time something super cool comes out on twitter.com/BenGreenfield, it seems like everybody's got a damn question about it.
Yes.
Everybody wants to know, does this apply to women? Does this apply to babies? What if I wanted to turn this into chocolate-covered peanut butter?
Yeah. So, and feed it to my lizard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And feed it to my lizard.
Is that a
euphemism?
I got my kids a pet lizard, so pretty much everything that happens in our home is in the context of what would the lizard think about this, or could the lizard eat it? It's one of those big, what do you call them, a dragon lizard? A dragon.
Oh, nice.
It's big. It's a big lizard. I forget what it's.
A Komodo?
No, it's not that big. It's not like a dog.
But it's going to eat your children.
Yeah, lounges on the couch. It is pretty big, though. Anyways,
where I was going with that was, this is the time of the show where Ben actually tells you whether you can feed it to a lizard or not.
Yeah. So here's an interesting one. The title of this headline is Stop Antibiotics, which I think is actually misleading because I'm not necessarily saying that everyone should stop their antibiotics. But this was actually something that was published in, I believe it was the MGA journal, which is a medical journal. I'm actually blanking on what MGA stands for. It's similar to the JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. But it was an article that was highlighting research which shows that if you stop the course of an antibiotic before a bacterial infection has been excluded, before the antibiotic has had a chance to completely knock out the bacteria, there's currently a common misconception that resistance will emerge if you don't complete that prescribed antibiotic course.
Yeah, that's how you make superbugs.
But or it's at least turning
that's
out.
What they say.
Yeah, they're saying there's no solid evidence for the recommended duration of therapy, and that there is no difference in outcome when shorter courses of antibiotics are used or if you don't complete the entire course of the antibiotic, like finish that whole, I don't know, like a Z-pack would be an example. So it's kind of interesting because I've always thought this too, right? Like in the rare cases that I have had to go on antibiotics, you know, like I messed around with them a little bit when I had like a MRSA infection, and there are some people that will use antibiotic courses for things like small intestine bacterial overgrowth. Anyways, though, what this article, and I'll link to it in the show notes along with everything else we talk about over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/311.
Yeah.
BenGreenfieldFitness.com/311. It's interesting because it turns out that based on emerging research, you may not indeed need to finish that course of antibiotics. So
you could just take it until you're feeling better and then save the rest for another day.
That's exactly what the article says. General practitioners are now being encouraged to tell most patients to stop treatment when they feel better after years of urging patients to finish their full course of antibiotics.
So where did the superbugs come from? I'm not specifically asking you. I'm just wondering out loud. If that's not how we created them, then where did they come from?
An evil villain on the spaceship on the moon.
That's got to be it.
That's it. That's exactly
absolutely
it.
Absolutely.
So another interesting article that I thought that was actually jam-packed with some pretty cool information or very practical information. It appeared over at Mark's Daily Apple. And this article is called, Is Your Workout Worth the Risk? And it cited a recent survey of CrossFit athletes and found that over 73% had experienced an injury during training, 7% of which required surgery. And then they also went into similar polls in runners that found that like 13% of runners experience knee injuries, 8% get Achilles tendonitis, 10% get plantar fasciitis, another 10% get shin splints, 14% get IT band friction syndrome. And it's just like there are so many training injuries that we get that the main thrust of the article was that if we're going to stay active and move our bodies and challenge our limits and climb our own, you know, personal Mount Everest to put a notch in our belt, but we don't want to get injured, how do we limit the injuries? And there were just some really practical tips. Like some of them were to, for example, train the deadlift and maintain the squat. Like a lot of athletes out there are doing deadlifts and squats. And this was based off of recommendations from human movement expert Gray Cook, who says that basically working on getting stronger at lifting something off the ground, right, like a deadlift, is a good idea. But the majority of injuries actually happen when people constantly try to increase their squat. Like you squat at heavier and heavier loads each week and eventually get to the point where you get injured or you blow out your knee or you blow out your back, and then you go back to square one after you've rehabbed. And the argument here is instead try to get heavier and heavier on the deadlift, but don't necessarily have it a goal to have unlimited growth potential in the squat. Get to the point where what the article says is everyone should be able to squat unassisted and unweighted, whether it's to poop while abroad, play blocks with your kids, or perform a nice morning grok stretch. And I'm kind of on the same page. I find that while I can consistently add weight and do heavier and heavier deadlifts, consistently adding weight with the squat, I almost always find that at some point something kind of, you know, gets a little tweak, a little ache, a little soreness, and then I gotta, you know, take a few weeks off of the squat and then return back to square one or close to it. So I like that recommendation: train the deadlift and maintain the squat.
Cool.
Another one is to leave some in the tank. They say that not every training session has to be a breakthrough workout or can be a breakthrough workout. You don't have to go to failure every time. So back off and occasionally don't get the extra rep and leave one. They say leave one or two or maybe even three in the tank. I think that's
another. As a coach, that is something I am constantly harping on all of my clients about. Like, stop going so hard. When I say easy, go easy.
Yeah, it's also something that I've been kind of focusing on more recently is using slightly less weight and focusing on very good form and then stopping as soon as form starts to go out the window. You know, even if my goal is 10 reps, if I get to 7 and form is going out the window, I'll stop. Another good one that I like is incorporate single arm and leg training. And the article says squats and deadlifts and overhead presses are great, but have you tried lunges, single leg deadlifts, and dumbbell presses? Assuming they're referring to like one arm overhead dumbbell presses. And yeah. I'm a huge fan of that whole unilateral loading concept. And I know that there are some very well-known strength coaches, like Mike Boyle is an example of a guy who doesn't have any of his athletes doing double leg squats anymore at all. They're all single leg, like pistol style squats or step-ups or high knee step-ups, and everything is unilateral simply because, you know, the logic there is that if you're an athlete or if you're moving, how often are you pushing around a weight with both feet planted versus launching or pushing or jumping your own body weight with just one foot or in an imbalanced side-to-side motion. So really good article, though. I just scratched the surface, so I'll link to that one over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/311 if you want to go read what our friends over at Mark's Daily Apple have to say about whether your workout is worth the risk and how to mitigate the risk potential. And then the last one is about saunas. And this is new data from a study on heart disease over in Finland. And the idea here is that they found that men who took more frequent saunas, as in 4 to 7 times per week, actually live longer than once per week sauna users. And I would imagine we could probably extrapolate this and say live longer than no per week sauna users. And they didn't really know the exact mechanism of action for the greater longevity, whether it's the time spent in the hot room or the relaxation time or the leisure of a life that allows for more time spent in the sauna or the camaraderie and fellowship that you might have in the sauna, just like talking to the guys or the girls or whatever. But ultimately – you know, I think that when you combine this with some of the scientific information that we unveiled when we talked with Dr. Rhonda Patrick, right, about how doing weekly or multiple time per week sauna treatments increases your production of heat shock proteins, increases your nitric oxide production, decreases blood pressure, increases stress resilience. There are a lot of really cool things. Increase in brain-derived neurotrophic factor, right, for neuronal growth. So even though this particular health benefits of sauna bathing article, and this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, even though it didn't get into a lot of those physiological effects, which surprised me because I would have thought that they would kind of, you know, look into some of that stuff. It turns out
otherwise
that,
it's pretty much just a socioeconomic study. Mm-hmm. Like people who can afford to go have a schwitz one to five times a week are obviously probably, you know, a better situation.
Yeah. I mean, and it may even be even a little bit of that, you know, your skin is your body's largest detoxification organ. And, you know, there could be some of that involved too, in terms of everything from like heavy metal to estrogen metabolite removal from sweating things out through your skin. So ultimately, I think that if you're listening in, you should be influenced by this as well as, you know, that podcast I did with Dr. Rhonda Patrick about the benefits of heat exposure to go out of your way. One, and you, I mean, even in this study, they were doing 4 to 7 times per week to just get warm or get hot or get, you know, an uncomfortable sweat going on for anything from 10 to 30 minutes. And my current protocol, just to give you an example of what I'm doing right now, is I go
right now. Are you in a sauna right now?
Right now, exactly.
I thought so. You sound so sweaty.
Well, I do. I don't know if this counts, but I have one of those infrared mats, right? I have this biomat, and I actually get pretty warm when I'm napping on that. And I take a nap almost every day. Sometimes it's just 10 minutes. Sometimes it's like 45 minutes. But every single day, I keep the biomat under the bed. I take it out. I unroll it. I put it on the bed. I turn it on high, and I just lay down on it. And that's one thing that I'll do for a kind of sort of sauna-esque treatment. But to get more specific with this article, I actually go to the sauna, the dry sauna. I'm not a huge fan of the wet sauna because of the potential for fungus, for mold, for the higher ability of like airborne pollutants to hang around in that moist air. But I go to the dry sauna, and I go to the dry sauna for about 30 to 40 minutes once a week. And generally what I'll do is either listen to a podcast or an audiobook and do yoga in the sauna, or I'll bring some magazine or pile of magazines that I've been wanting to get around to, and I'll just sit there in the sauna and read them. And so that's one thing that I do. And then I also right now am playing tennis twice a week, and the place where I play tennis has saunas. So after I'm kind of warm, you know, after playing tennis for anything from 60 to 90 minutes, I'll go in the sauna for about 10 minutes before I head home. And after each of those sauna sessions, those two 10-minute sessions and that one 30-minute session, I take a nice cold shower for just, you know, 2-3 minutes, step out. You know, that way I'm not all sweaty and grody when I walk in the door. I'm not sweating on the car seat. And that's it. So that's my current sauna protocol if you want to kind of get your creative wheels churning about ways that you could get the sauna in. But ultimately, it turns out that if you're a Finnish – and B, you're willing to step into a sauna 4 to 7 times per week, that it may lend you a little bit of longevity. So there you go. You don't need to exercise. You don't need to eat healthy. All you got to do is hit the sauna with all of your other Finnish friends.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. Put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their sexual performance booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order.
Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just three times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com.
Listener Q&A.
Hi, Ben and Brock. How's it going? This is Niraj. Been following you for a long time. Thanks for all that you do. I had a question related to acid alkaline diets for endurance athletes. Recently, you had talked about a study that showed that supplementing with sodium bicarbonate helped increase time to exhaustion in endurance athletes. Did this have anything to do with the alkalizing properties of sodium bicarbonate? There are also products like Acid Check that claim to alkalize the body and improve performance and recovery in endurance athletes. What are your thoughts on this? Does it make sense to supplement with sodium bicarbonate and or products like Acid Check? Should endurance athletes make their diets more alkaline? Thanks.
I have a funny story about baking soda, Brock.
I have a feeling I know where this is going.
So baking soda, among other things that we'll talk about briefly, is a great way to get things moving in the morning, if you know what I mean. It's actually wonderful if you're constipated.
Oh, yeah.
And you need to get things moving. Baking soda causes increased intestinal peristalsis. It basically causes you to poo things out. And also, because it's a mineral, it attracts a lot of water into your large intestine. So as long as you're careful to rehydrate afterwards, and preferably even, you know, get a little bit of sea salt and electrolytes into your system afterwards to rehydrate you.
And don't leave the house.
It's a good way to get your morning bowel movement. But I experimented with baking soda, and like I do in many cases, rather than starting with the minimum effective dose and working my way up, I instead start with the largest possible dose to induce Dumb and Dumber style feet over your ears liquid poo explosions into the toilet and then work my way down. So I started
with... You were talking about this in the inner circle, what we're doing now video, weren't you?
I think you
said something about wiping down the toilet when you were done.
Yeah.
That's a little graphic.
Yeah. You may want to have some baby wipes nearby. Anyways, though, no, you don't, because I've done all the hard work for you, or in this case, the soft, mushy work for you. 3 teaspoons is too much, folks. I've found the magic dose, at least for a guy like me. I'm about 180 pounds. About a slightly heaping teaspoon stirred into a glass of water in the morning, and I actually mix it with lemon juice for an even more potent alkalinizing effect, which I'll talk about why I do that in a second. And then about a half hour later, you have a glorious morning bowel movement. And if you really want to get things moving, you drink this morning alkalinic tonic, and then you do some yoga moves that are traditional yoga moves to get things moving down there. Like you can do like some cat-cow, right, where you get into a crawl position and you arch your back and then extend, which is also great for moving spinal fluid. And you do the yoga move where you just lay on the ground on your back and you pull one knee to your chest for about 30 seconds and then the other knee to your chest. And then a really good one is just like getting into a deep, deep squat and stretching your adductors. But I'm telling you what, and I'm actually working on an article about this for the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast about like a morning habit that can help you to have a nice morning poo. Because I actually got a lot of questions about the fact that all I do is like a giant morning 40-pound poo, and then I don't go to the bathroom anymore the rest of the day.
I think it was the 10 to 15 minutes as well. It's like, what?
10 to 15
minutes.
Your legs
fall asleep after that long.
Nah, not if you're on a squatty potty. Anyways, though, so kind of a segue from Niraj's question, because he wants to know about this for performance benefits, not just poo.
Wait, I got to stop with that. That's not a segue. That's like a rat hole or a rabbit hole. A segue is actually a transition. That was just purely going off in a different direction that nobody wanted us to go.
Deep, dark rabbit hole. So, exactly. Yes, sodium bicarbonate, which is in fact kind of the active ingredient in something like a baking soda, that is a known ergogenic aid, similar to caffeine. Like caffeine is another one. Creatine is another one. There's actually, believe it or not, very few straight up ergogenic aids that in just about every study that have been done on them show benefit. So when we're looking at sodium bicarbonate or baking soda, what studies have shown is that when you take, and I'm going to give you the, I'll let you, if you're listening in, go and do the math on this, but here's the amount. You take about 0.3 grams per kilogram of body weight.
Whoa, that's quite a lot.
0.3 grams per kilogram body weight. Important here, 2 hours before any exercise that has the potential to produce a lot of lactic acid or a lot of hydrogen ions, pretty much anything that's like glycolytic, short, intense, you know, even like a sprint triathlon or a short Spartan race would qualify as something like that. You take it with water. And preferably to stave off some of that gastric upset, you also take it with carbohydrates like sweet potato or yam or something like that. And you actually do get an acid buffering effect when you use it. Sodium bicarbonate is the one that you would want. Sodium citrate, which you'll often find as a flavoring agent and as a preservative in foods like club soda, for example, that's less studied and may not work quite as well as baking soda. But sodium bicarbonate, literally like the Arm & Hammer style baking soda, 0.3 grams per kilogram of body weight, and of course, for the reasons that I just described regarding intestinal peristalsis, try it before you buy it. Don't necessarily do this before your big, whatever, Iron Man that you've been training for 9 months, unless you want a messy wetsuit. So endurance exercise, definitely the ergogenic benefits have been known for quite some time. More recently, they've studied baking soda's effect on weightlifting, which also has the potential to create an acidic state due to the lactic acid that's produced during weight training. And when I say lactic acid, yeah, I know. Lactic acid is, now we all know it's a good thing. It gets shuttled up to the liver and converted into glucose, and it's used as a energy metabolite. But when I say lactic acid, I'm really talking about the hydrogen ions that during that process of using lactic acid get kicked off. Those are what increase the acidity, but it's just lactic acid is an easier way to kind of say it. Lactic acid is synonymous with those hydrogen ions being formed. So baking soda induces this alkalosis, which buffers some of those hydrogen ions and manages the pH of your blood. So when we're looking at weight training, a recent study looked at resistance training, and in the study they used 80% of their max weight on the squat and the bench press. They did three sets of each exercise to failure. And on random days, in random order, they compared baking soda with a placebo. And in this case, it was taken an hour before lifting. And the baking soda significantly improved the squat performance. It was actually more than a 25% improvement. The average total reps over three sets without baking soda was about 24. And with baking soda, it was about 31. So they actually were able to get, seven extra reps over the course of the workout in the squat. And that's pretty significant. And what they used in this case was 0.3 grams. That actually comes out to being somewhat close to like a little less than a teaspoon, I believe, dissolved in a sweetened fluid. So they actually, they combine it with a little bit of carbohydrate to stave off any type of gastric distress.
But it's 0.3 grams per kilogram of body weight.
It's 0.3 for endurance studies. What they found is 3 milligrams, right? I'm thinking of caffeine. 0.3 grams per kilogram of body weight 2 hours before exercise is what they've used in endurance studies. Okay. In this weight training study, all they used was 0.3 grams. That relatively small amount compared to endurance exercise. Yeah. So either way, we know you can get away. Like for me, I would say, use about a teaspoon or less than a teaspoon and just kind of experiment a little bit before you take this to the streets or to your local, CrossFit box or whatever. So, yeah. And then,
don't be that guy.
A lot of people will say, oh, you can't change the alkalinity of the blood because the pH of your blood is regulated by all the natural buffers of the human body. And it is kind of true. Like if the pH of your blood falls below about 7.3, that's a condition called acidosis. And that can lead to some pretty significant central nervous system depression. And severe acidosis where your pH goes below 7, that can cause coma and it can even cause death. Now, if the pH of your blood goes above about 7.45, that's called alkalosis. And in this case, that's not necessarily a good thing. And this is why you need to be careful if you have one of these alkalinizing like countertop water units, because severe alkalosis can lead to all the nerves in your body to become hypersensitive and overexcitable. It can lead to seizures, muscle spasms, extreme nervousness, anxiety, convulsions, and in some cases getting too alkaline, it can cause death. I haven't heard of anybody dying from countertop water units, but I have spoken with people who got them, and one person in particular, their kid started having seizures, and they had this thing dialed up to the max, way up at the maximum of alkalinity. So you got to be careful with this stuff. So the pH, of course, for those of you who need to remember back to Chemistry 101 or who never had the pleasure of taking it, that's just a measure of how acidic or alkaline that a liquid is. And when we look at this with respect to human health, those liquids are your body fluids. So you have your intracellular fluid, and that's all the fluid that's found inside all of your cells, as the name would imply, intracellular fluid. And that's also often called cytosol. And that makes up about 2/3 of the total amount of fluid in your whole body. It's just hanging around inside your cells. It's called cytosol. And then you have your extracellular fluid. And that's all the fluid that's outside the cells. And it's basically made up of plasma. That's the fluid that makes up all of your blood. And then interstitial fluid. And that's all of the fluid inside the spaces that surround your tissue. So that would be like fluid that's found in your eyes and in your joints and between all the membranes that surround like your abdominal cavities and your respiratory cavities. So when we look at all of these liquids, your cells actually require your blood to maintain a pH that's right in the range of about 7.35 to 7.45 in order for all of your necessary metabolic functions to happen the right way. So 7.35 to 7.45. And for the most part, you have buffering systems that help this to occur really, really well. You have, for example, what's called your carbonic acid and bicarbonate buffer system, which allows you to like breathe off CO2 and get rid of acidity that way. Your proteins have a buffer system. You've got another buffer system that's made up of phosphates. And then you also are able to eliminate hydrogen ions via your kidneys. And we look at the kidneys and we look at respiration and we look at the buffer systems in your blood. For the most part, your body does a pretty good job regulating pH all by itself. So the question then is, why would you want to use things like, you know, baking soda or apple cider vinegar or lemon juice or any of these things that we say are alkalinizing? Well, the reason is that if you look at something like, let's say, one of those buffer systems, like the phosphate buffer system, well, the way that that one works is it uses different what are called phosphate ions in your body to neutralize acids. And almost 90% of those phosphate ions that are used in this phosphate buffer system come from calcium phosphate, or calcium phosphate salts is what they're called. And those are the structural components of your bones and your teeth. So if your body's fluids get regularly exposed to these big quantities of acid-forming foods and liquids, processed sugars, starches, red meats can be up there when consumed in excess amounts, commercial dairy, things like that, your body draws on its calcium phosphate reserves to supply your phosphate buffer system with what it needs to buffer the acid-forming effects of your diet. So over time, you can look at things like osteoporosis or, you know, degrading the teeth, for example. So when we're looking at this acid-alkaline balance, yes, your body can buffer acids, but it can be stressful on your body to have to constantly be doing so. And that's why I'm always careful to eat foods that have a moderate alkalinizing effect, or at least include things like that in the diet on a regular basis. So baking soda can do that. Lemon juice can do that. There are other examples, like sprouts are really good. Garlic is really good. Ginger is fantastic for this. And you can easily do a search for like acid alkaline food charts and just like hang one on your refrigerator. So you start to get familiar with the fact that, for example, you know, all those things that we would suspect, like alcohol and pop and soda, you know, tobacco, coffee, sugar, stuff like that, that's all acidic. And then, you know, many of these other, mostly produce, really, they're, you know, it's highly alkalinic. Mm. So that's the idea, is, you know, this gives you more than a performance effect. It's also a health effect that you get when you're consuming alkalinizing compounds like this. One other thing I should mention is aluminum. Yeah, have you heard of this, Brock, that there's concerns about, like, aluminum and baking soda?
Like, in the stuff that we're just buying to make baking with?
Yeah, there's this myth out there that baking soda has aluminum in it.
Oh, I haven't heard
and,
that.
And, yeah, well, you obviously have not been spending a lot of time on all the internet forums in which people are concerned about heavy metals and the stuff that they eat. I don't know what you're doing with your time, but seriously, bro.
I don't go to those kind of heavy metal forms. Yeah. I go to the other kind of heavy metal forms.
I think part of it is because baking soda is in a lot of antiperspirants. And so because antiperspirants and deodorants have aluminum in them, people think the baking soda has aluminum in it. But baking soda, most anything you're going to buy in the store is just 100% sodium bicarbonate. That's all that it is. Now, baking powder, on the other hand, that has sodium bicarbonate, but they also put ingredients in it that act as acidifying agents, because sometimes when you add something that's too alkalinic to a recipe, you don't get the leavening action, right? Like, that's why baking powder would be, like, if I make quiche, for example, I'll scramble up I'll stir up a bunch of eggs with some coconut milk, and I'll chop up some avocado, and I'll put that in there, but then I'll put a teaspoon of baking powder in there, so that when I put that in the oven, it'll rise nicely and make this nice fluffy quiche. Now, if that baking powder is too alkalinic, then that won't happen. But unfortunately, one of the acidifying agents that they'll use, in addition to something called cream of tartar, and that's the better acidifying agent to use, another one that a lot of folks will use is an aluminum-based acid. So that's why if you're buying baking powder, you want to look for the aluminum-free designation on the label. But with baking soda does not contain aluminum. Even probably the most famous example, the Arm & Hammer, that's 100% sodium bicarbonate. So if you're looking for aluminum-free, realize it's baking powder where that matters, not baking soda. Now, I realize that this is a really long response. I promise that my responses to all the questions won't be this long if you're listening in and you're concerned about this being a two-hour-long podcast. But you'll note that Niraj also asked about supplements, right? Like these supplements that are considered acid-reducing supplements, like, for example, this acid check that he talked about, which is actually marketed as a body acid reducer. And I've actually seen ads for this in, like, Lava magazine, for example. And when you look at the ingredients of acid check, it is essentially salts, calcium, magnesium, and potassium, for example, in their capsule is what you'll find. And when you look at the ingredient label, calcium carbonate, magnesium hydroxide, potassium chloride, and then also just some fillers like magnesium stearate and silica and stuff like that. Ultimately, the mechanism of action of something like this is very, very similar to that of sodium bicarbonate, meaning that it has just like this alkalinizing effect that helps to buffer. Those are all buffers, calcium carbonate, magnesium hydroxide, potassium hydroxide. So you're potentially paying a lot of money for something that you may be able to simulate the effects of with baking soda. The only caveat here is that many times when you're using something like calcium and magnesium and potassium, these may have less of an intestinal peristaltic effect than baking soda. And so if you find that you do get the dumb and dumber effect from baking soda, even in small amounts, that's where you may want to try something like a mix of different buffers. But understand that really there's nothing special about any of these formulas. They're just salts. You know, they're calcium salts and magnesium salts and potassium salts mixed into a capsule. And then, you know, a label is slapped on them and they're sold for, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 times more than what the actual ingredients cost. And I have nothing against capitalism, right? Like if you come out with a good product and you package it in a convenient way that helps people, fine. But just know if you're listening in that it's just a buffer. You could probably get something similar with baking soda. But the advantage of the baking soda is that you also get a nice poo.
We're definitely going to have to use a screenshot from Dumb and Dumber for this podcast post.
Haven't we done that in like two other posts though?
Yeah, we've got it on hand.
We definitely have that one in the, how do they say, in the coffers.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Ben. What are some natural ways to increase your glutathione production? I don't really want to spend any more money on buying the liquid glutathione, although I know it's effective. So any insight you have would be great. Thank you and keep up the great work.
Any way you can do it without taking liposomal glutathione that tastes like, what did we decide it was? Dog farts
liquid,
meets perm?
Liquid
hair perm?
Yeah, liquid dog farts meets perm solution. Yeah. Two of the more sulfurous compounds known to man. What comes out of a dog's behind and what you smear in your hair to make it curly, both are pretty full of sulfur. And that's why when you take like this sublingual glutathione, which I was talking about earlier, it actually is something that I'll take when I travel. And yes, I do pop some mint gum afterwards because it gives you this nice sulfurous dragon breath. But glutathione is, it's what's known as like the master antioxidant. And it's just a molecule that has three different proteins in it, or amino acids, cysteine, glutamine, and glycine. And so your body, with adequate amounts of those amino acids in it, can produce its own glutathione. And the fact is that most glutathione that you would actually consume that is the glutathione molecule, unless it is sublingual, it's not very well absorbed in your digestive tract. That is why you have to put up with this nasty sulfur breath if you are going to use glutathione in its straight up supplemental form. Now, why would you need extra? Well, technically, you only really need extra when you're stressed, right? Like when you've been doing airline travel or when you've had a very, very difficult workout and you need to, you know, fight off a little bit of extra inflammation or perhaps
you've been pounding the brewskis.
Yeah. Or maybe you've got a low intake of amino acids. I don't know. Maybe you're vegan or you're vegetarian and you're not doing a good job with your soaking and your sprouting and your fermenting. And so, you know, you need help producing your own antioxidants just because your amino acid intake is low. But either way, like you don't have to use a glutathione supplement. It can be expensive. And like I mentioned, unless you get this stuff that doesn't taste very well that you put into your mouth, then you are going to be wasting your money anyways because it's not really going to be absorbed. So as you would probably guess, some of the best things to increase your own natural glutathione production are the stinky, sulfur-rich vegetables. Some of my favorites would be like garlic, onions, parsley is pretty good, and then, of course, your cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, kale to a certain extent has some. So
you described my lunch.
Yeah, I mean, you can easily work this into, you know, salads, smoothies, things along those lines. Like I'll often put parsley and cilantro in with kale in a morning green smoothie. And usually I'll put some avocado in there as well. And avocado actually has some sulfur in it also. So that's a big thing. Be aware that cooking, because it will degrade some of those amino acids and break apart the glutathione molecule, it can reduce the glutathione content of vegetables by up to 60%. And when you can a vegetable, you get complete elimination of glutathione. So just know that the way that you prepare those vegetables, preferably in like their raw, unadulterated form, is pretty good. A lot of people have heard of this before, and it is true. Whey protein has pretty much every glutathione precursor you would need in it. It's got cysteine, it's got lactoferrin, it's got peptides, it's got what are called immunoglobulins. And so like a good whey protein, you know, preferably like a whey protein powder that does not contain artificial sweeteners, that does not contain a bunch of extras, that preferably is not in a giant can that you bought from the bargain bin at the supplement store and has either a photo of a woman with cut abs in a bikini on it or a guy doing some type of pose while making a gritting teeth face on it.
Also wearing a bikini of some sort.
Those would be the whey proteins to avoid. So there are some whey – like I use the there's a few that are I quote unquote approve. Mount Capra has a goat based protein. The molecule of goat whey is a little bit smaller. It's a little bit more biodynamically favorable. And by the way, we are buying our goats next month for our little goat pen we're building out here. So yeah,
cute.
Yeah. So pretty soon I won't need to buy.
I won't need to buy
colostrum.
Them?
No, I'm just going to go out there and suck the teat each morning for the colostrum.
Oh, good.
And then. Yeah, as far as the whey goes, we'll be able to make our own whey out of the milk. So anyways, though, a good non-denatured whey protein that preferably comes from something other than a cow. But if you are going to go with a cow, look for a grass-fed cow and look for a protein that's cold processed without a lot of sweeteners or other additives. I'll put a link to a few good whey proteins.
Grass-fed was pointless when it was a whey protein.
That is true. If it's a whey protein isolate, that doesn't contain a lot of the actual, the dairy proteins, going with grass-fed organic is not quite as important as just looking for the absence of like artificial sweeteners and things along those lines. So, grass-fed whey concentrate, on the other hand, which is a little bit different than the isolate, you'd want to go for grass-fed if you're getting like a whey protein concentrate or whey protein mixed with a casein. As far as like a whey protein isolate, grass-fed isn't necessarily something that you have to do. Now whey concentrate, for people who can tolerate lactose, whey protein concentrate usually has more of the lactoferrins, more of the immunoglobulins, more of what's called the albumin in it. And so it's technically a more complete protein source. But people who are sensitive to lactose, including myself, have trouble with whey concentrate, whereas whey isolate has little to no fat. It's got minimal carbohydrate in it. But a lot of times the extra benefits of the cattle being grass-fed when it comes to a whey protein isolate are not quite as high. So it may not be worth the extra money to buy like a grass-fed whey isolate and just look for something that comes from cows that aren't treated with hormones and a protein that isn't loaded with like artificial colors or sweeteners. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool. So whey protein isolate, that'd be another way in addition to the sulfur-based vegetables to kind of kickstart your own glutathione production. A few other ways that you could do this. One would be anything that would be like a farm type of product, like fresh raw milk or raw eggs. Both of those have been shown to promote glutathione production. But once you treat them with heat, that obliterates a lot of the proteins, a lot of the cofactors, and a lot of the live cultures that allow you to produce your own glutathione from those sources. So you would
technically obliterates it, eh?
Obliterates. So you would technically have to get something unpasteurized. Right. So if you're, you know, in many states this is tough, but like fresh raw milk and raw eggs from a local farm that haven't been heat processed, that will help you to produce your own glutathione. Alpha-lipoic acid helps your body to regenerate its own glutathione. And one of the best ways to get alpha-lipoic acids are red meats and organ meats. And again, everything in moderation. I just got done talking about acidity and alkalinity. And if you were to eat liver every day, and if you were to eat giant portions of red meat every day, you would get a lot of glutathione precursors, but you would also be getting a pretty big net acidic load. And that, you know, for that reason, I'm pretty careful. I alternate. I do fish and eggs some days, and I'll do red meat some days. I'll do some type of a liver meat or organ meat once every week to once every 2 weeks. But I'm not doing bacon for breakfast and some cut up steak on my salad for lunch, and then, you know, a giant cut of beef for dinner. Like, I'm careful with the meat. I don't do too much of it, but I do include it. So that's something to be careful with as well, all you paleo folks who worship the beef, the almighty beef. Just be careful. And then finally, curcumin. Curcumin. I'm doing an experiment right now. I had a tennis match on Sunday, and about halfway through that tennis match, I tweaked my knee a little bit. And so I have been using curcumin. And this morning, I actually took, speaking of the baking soda experiment and starting big, I took 4 grams of curcumin this morning just to see what the pain-killing effect was like. Because unlike Tylenol or ibuprofen, it has a pretty potent pain-killing and anti-inflammatory effect, but it does not do a number on your gut. So I went with high-dose curcumin this morning, but interestingly, that can also enhance glutathione metabolism. Now, I have had no ill effects, aside from the fact that my toenails are yellow, and I'm peeing like orange-ish, and the toilet really smells like curry. No, I'm just kidding.
No. I was concerned there for a second, yeah, like, you should go honestly, to the hospital. You
know, maybe it's total placebo, but my knee feels fine right now. And this was like 2 hours ago I took. I used the Thorn Rebound. It's 1 gram in 2 capsules. I took 8 capsules of it just to see what the pain-killing effect was like. So,
and?
Feel good. Good. Nice. So just use like a good high quality source of curcumin, and know that curcumin is not absorbable unless it's bound to like a fat. So you want to look for a curcumin phytosome. Many supplement companies nowadays use a form out of India called Meriva, M-E-R-I-V-A. That's the form of curcumin you want to look for if you want both the glutathione production and also the pain killing effects. I'll put links to a lot of this stuff over in the show notes, but those are some of the best ways to increase your glutathione without getting liquid dog fart breath.
Hey, Ben. My name's Jason, and recently I've been using a product called Primal Sports Mud to help with recovery after a hard workout. You apply a thin layer of this mud to the affected area, you wrap it, and you apply heat, and it's supposed to help aid in muscle recovery. So my question is, how exactly does applying a topical solution to your skin help your muscles recover faster? Big fan of the podcast. Thanks for everything you guys do, and I hope to hear from you soon.
You ever heard of this stuff, Brock?
I think I have. I thought it was I'm thinking of Primal Paste, which is a deodorant.
That's a deodorant. So yeah. I have this video over on YouTube. It's actually not doing too bad. It's got 1,311 views on it. And it is me in a Speedo smearing Dead Sea mud all over my body.
Oh, when you were in the Middle East.
Got some interesting comments on that video, including, yeah, but will this help me during an Ironman, bro, is one question. One comment. Another comment says, you're such a smug bastard, Greenfield. I'd kick your lanky ass. that's a good one. What are the other comments on this video? Someone has it looks like a spam comment about anti-hair loss and regrowth shampoo. Not really sure how that one made it through onto the video. I'll put a link to this video in the show notes. I'll just embed the video in the show notes if you want to view it.
Yeah, then you don't have to go to YouTube and see the comment section, because nobody needs to read the comment section.
Dead Sea mud is something that's really rich, though, in minerals. It's got like magnesium and sodium and potassium and calcium. And it's been studied quite a bit for its health benefits and its healing properties. And that's why so many people do like I did, and they go to the Dead Sea to like smear this mud on their body or do like Dead Sea mud treatments. And a lot of spas will offer these mud masks and mud treatments. So if you look at like facial skin, you can minimize pores, you can decrease wrinkles when you use mud to draw things out of your face. And there are even these masks that they sell that you can literally mix with a little water and you keep, you know, in your bathroom. Typically it's clay and it produces a mud type texture, and you smear that on your face and you leave it on there for like an hour, and then you rinse it off and hope that the mailman doesn't come to the door during the time that your face is covered in mud.
Or so, you hope that he does.
Exactly. Hey, man. Or the pool boy. Okay, so anyways, a few other things in terms of the mineral content of, for example, this Dead Sea mud that a lot of people use. It's got these minerals that help to accelerate exfoliation. As you just learned, minerals have an effect on pH. Your skin does have a pH, and mud or minerals can help to restore your skin's pH balance. When you look at something like topical magnesium and magnesium baths that a lot of people take, one of the reasons they do this is it promotes blood circulation. Another reason they'll do it is it'll offset calcium, which can cause some soreness. And so you can get a little bit of a decrease in soreness, little bit of an improvement in circulation. And some people even smear Dead Sea mud on areas that have cellulite for this increased circulation that may help some of that cottage cheese like fat appearance to get flattened out. They found there was one research study that was done at Ben Gurion University in Israel that found that patients that were treated with mud compresses taken from mineral-rich Dead Sea mud reported less knee pain from osteoarthritis. So that was interesting. But of course, you know, whenever it comes out of Israel, which is where the Dead Sea is, you always got to wonder whether it, you know, might possibly be skewed research or, you know, affected by the fact that it is one of the major tourism destinations in Israel. So, you know, in looking at some of the other studies that were, for example, in the Journal of Rheumatology, in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, the Journal of Clinical Rheumatology, Joint and Spine Journal, and I'll put a link to this over in the show notes, some of the PubMed research. There's actually a lot of research with mud packs for chronic low back pain, for arthritic issues, for smearing mud on joints, and it actually helping. It can help to draw fluid and inflammation out of a joint when you use like a mud compress or a mud rub. So a lot of really interesting studies on the effects of mud, particularly on skin health, on wrinkles, and on joint health. Now, when we turn to this primal sport mud stuff, unfortunately, I think that maybe they need to go to this science to give themselves a little bit more accreditation, shall we say? Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. here's what they say about primal sports mud. Maybe we should play some mystical music as I read this. Some mystical Eastern music. When heat is applied to primal sports mud, its jet black color and molecular structure absorb and convert the heat into beneficial infrared energy, which stimulates microcirculation, improves circulation, removes toxins, and speeds up recovery, so you can spend less time being sore and more time doing what moves you. Primal sport mud is all natural, raw, and exactly what your body needs. Thank you. You can mail your checks to me. Anyways, though, so yeah, I mean, their description of it is a little bit more airy fairy woo woo. I don't know about this whole. I couldn't find any studies that showed that the molecular structure of mud can help to convert heat into infrared energy. I'm not sure about all of that. All I know is that there's minerals in mud. Okay, I'll put this simplistically. There's minerals in mud, and those can have an effect. Everything else that they're claiming on this site, I don't know about. I haven't seen any research about. I'm not sure if there's any difference between this and just like getting yourself some dirt, right? Like some good mud from your garden and smearing it on your body or on your joints. With the exception being that since this stuff is packaged in a sexy little bottle and everything, maybe it's worth it. And maybe the folks from Primal Sports Mud will write us and tell us about some magical ingredient in their mud that I don't know about, because I actually wasn't able to find a full ingredient list for this stuff. But ultimately, yeah.
That's never a good sign.
Yeah. There are some benefits to mud, for sure. kind of like what was something else we were talking about earlier, like the baking soda thing, right? Like you may be able to just go for baking soda instead of an overpriced supplement. You may be able to just go for mud from your backyard rather than, you know, Primal Sports mud. But
what if you're going to wrap and then heat as well? It feels like you could probably just wrap and apply heat and it would probably feel pretty nice as well without the mud.
I like to go and just roll around in my garden bed. That's my wife gets kind of pissed because I dig up all the onions, but it's nice.
Hello, Ben and Brock. My name is Tyler, and my case today surrounds what is labeled snapping hip syndrome. Basically, when I'm lying on my back and I go to lower my left leg, just before the foot meets the ground, I hear this loud clunking noise. And although I'm not in any pain, I have restricted mobility in my left hip or psoas, which inhibits me from doing any long or strenuous running or cycling without that right side overcompensating and flaring up with tightness in the TFL and IT band and all that good stuff. So really I'm looking for any input you might have on releasing a impinged hip and maybe some insight that goes beyond the traditional smashing or stretching, as I do this religiously and still have not found any relief whatsoever. So thank you guys and keep up the amazing work with the podcast.
I've got snapping hips. Snap. I got snapping knees. I got snapping shoulders.
Ooh, snap.
Snap.
Snap. Yeah, I mean, snapping hip syndrome happens actually to a lot of athletes, and it occurs for two different reasons. You can get what's called extra articular snapping hip syndrome, and usually that happens when one leg is longer than the other. Sometimes it can happen when your IT band is really tight. Sometimes it can happen when you have weak, what are called external rotators. And you see this in a lot of runners, like a lot of endurance athletes who do like chronic repetitive motion and not enough side-to-side motion. And you get this popping. The actual sound that you're hearing is when the thick part of the IT band or the front part of the gluteus maximus, what's called the anterior gluteus maximus, those are rubbing over that bony point on the outside of your hip. It's called your greater trochanter. Okay, so basically it is a muscular imbalance or a leg length discrepancy that causes actual soft tissue, like tendons, to rub over the outside of your hip. Now, it can also happen with what's called an intra-articular effect. An intra-articular snapping is usually when you've torn something. That's like a torn labrum, or you've rocked your hip out of joint a few times. It's called a hip subluxation. Hmm. You've got like an articular cartilage tear. You've got cartilage breakdown in the hip, and that's less common. Usually that's going to happen like to people who are really old / have beat up their bodies a lot with like a ton of running. Typically it's the extra articular snapping hip syndrome that you're experiencing. And like I mentioned, sometimes you got to go down the rabbit hole. Did I use that term correctly, Brock?
I believe you did.
And do some digging. So you look at the flexibility of your IT band. I'm not saying super flexible IT bands are a good thing because you want some amount of tension in your legs to produce force. But for example, if you're rolling your IT band and it's just teeth grittingly bad and you have very, very little external rotator flexibility in your IT band, then that might be an issue. Like if you're unable to sit cross-legged in a chair comfortably, that can be a pretty good sign that your IT band is too tight. So when you're looking at leg length differences, typically you actually need to get an X-ray to determine a true anatomical leg length discrepancy. But more often, leg length discrepancies are due to issues with mobility in what's called your sacroiliac joint. So if you go see a good sports chiropractor, they could not only tell you that your IT band or if your IT band is tight, but they can also evaluate your SI joint and even adjust your SI joint if it's too tight. So that's another route you could go, is to get your SI joint looked at. And then finally, when I'm talking about weakness in the abductors and the external rotators causing that anterior part of the gluteus maximus to snap over the greater trochanter of your hip, best way to fix that is to, you know, a lot of people like to do the clamshell exercise. Have you seen this one, Brock? crawl like position and you hike your leg. People call that the fire hydrant exercise because it's like
I
the
call
dog.
It Jane, it's the Jane Fonda.
The Jane Fonda. What's that exercise device she created? The thought. What's it called? Thighmaster?
It wasn't Jane Fonda. That was from the lady from Three's Company, Suzanne Summers.
Yeah, the other exercise lady. So
the other blonde exercise lady.
The other one.
From the 70s.
So, yeah, from the 70s, exactly, before I was born. Anyways, though, the
whatever.
I like better than that because I think it's more functional when you're standing and doing this. I like wrapping the elastic band or the mini band between the ankles and doing the side to side monster walks. Exactly. Yeah. That's a really good one that you can just do on a weekly basis, literally to failure. Like I'll throw that in sometimes when I haven't been doing a lot of side to side or haven't made it out on the trails much to do like much side to side movement is I'll just go back and forth with that band and literally walk across the room until the outside of both hips is just like done, just fatigued, and that's it. So those are some of the things I would go after. I mean, if you have to, you can get like corticosteroid injections and that'll decrease some of the pain. And you can like some people will even get like surgical treatment for the intra-articular stuff. But everything I just described to you, 90% of the time, it gets rid of this snap in the hips. I used to get this all the time when I was doing triathlon until I started focusing on my external rotator strength and my IT band tightness. So those are the things that I would look at when it comes to your snapping hip.
Speaking of snap, have we got an iTunes review this week?
We do.
Give away some swag.
Yeah, so if you leave a review in iTunes right after you finish voting in the podcast awards, because you're just going to spread good karma all over the place like mud, then if you
karmatize
hear us,
everything.
If you hear us read your review on the show, you need to email, and it's actually a different email address now. It's you email gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems. No. Did I say that right? gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. Yeah. gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. If you hear your review read on the show and you email gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com, then we will mail you gear. We'll specifically send you a Ben Greenfield Fitness water bottle, a cool tech t-shirt, and a sweet little beanie, which I was actually wearing at the gym yesterday. And
I was wearing it on the trails yesterday.
Nice. If you want to support the show, you can go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/gear and just like buy that stuff. But ultimately, looks like we have a review from Hugo ABQ, and they say, highly recommend this podcast. They give us 5 stars.
Five stars.
Awesome. And Brock, you want to take this one away?
Yeah, first I'm going to say, Hugo ABQ, if you do hear this and you write into gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com, do not be freaked out by the amount of S's in that email address.
There are a lot of S's, yes.
Yeah, it freaks me out every time. But anyway, the review goes like this. The Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast is in my top 2 health and fitness podcasts. It's in his top 2. So
who's the other one? Who's he cheating on us with?
Ben sifts through all the latest
research.
Better
not be Jillian Michaels.
Oh. Actually, I was thinking it would probably be Rich Roll. That would make me even more angry.
No, I like Rich Roll, but I don't know Jillian. Maybe I like Jillian Michaels. I don't know, but I haven't hung out with her. So it can't be Jillian Michaels, Hugo ABQ, or we won't send you stuff. All right, go ahead, Brock.
There you go. Ben sifts through all the latest research and presents it in a concise, not today, concise went out the window with the first question today, unbiased, he's batting 0 for 2 at the moment, concise, unbiased.
Yeah, because I'm not only inconcise and I drone on, I'm not unbiased because I'm on the board of like 20 different companies.
You're horribly biased.
I'm horribly biased. And what's the last one?
Easy to digest. Format.
Yeah. I would say that because we even showed him how to poo.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'll buy that one. Okay. So absolutely. He's batting 1 for 3.
Okay.
Good for you, Hugo. And unlike other podcast hosts like Jillian Michaels or for troll. Ben has the self-experimentation results and fitness credentials to back up advice.
No, I'm going to back up, though. And again, I'm only saying this, Brock, because Rich Roll is a friend of mine. And I don't want him to think that I said something bad about him.
No, it's me. It's okay. Me.
It's totally you. I have no clue what your beef is with Rich Roll, but just for the record, I did not say anything about you, Rich, because I know you listen into each show as you're sitting by the fire eating your kale in quinoa. So go ahead, Brock.
My biggest beef with Rich is he's so damn handsome. I hate him. I have extracted several useful nuggets of information. Oh, man, I'm such a child.
More
I can't
than one
read
nugget
the word
today.
I have extracted several useful nuggets of information from this podcast and highly recommend you listen.
Well, Hugo, that's even though that was a train wreck, dude, we're still going to send you stuff.
It's like four sentences, and it took us 10 minutes to get through it.
So right into the show. Folks, if you're listening in still, which I really doubt you are, we're going to cut you loose. Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/311. Stay tuned this weekend for yet another fantastic weekend show. And that one
forest
is going
bathing.
To be about forest bathing, which is more than just rolling around in your garden bed getting covered in mud. It's going to be a cool one. And then finally, the last thing, and I'm totally blanking here. I was going to say something super important. This is great podcasting, by the way. I was going to say something super important. I've briefly blanked on it, and now I remember it. If you're not subscribed to the Ben Greenfield Fitness newsletter, do it, because I have a super duper cool announcement coming on Monday, the 9th, about some cool stuff I'm sending out via this new thing called Quarterly. So check that out if you want to get on the Quarterly.
You're getting on that horse,
eh? It's going to be a very limited number of people who get a Quarterly box shipped straight to their doorstep. But stay tuned to the newsletter for that. You can sign up for it for free at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. The Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Here it is.
Visit bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.